The speaker tonight is a person I've known basically since he came into the rooms, and I like this version a lot better, for real. And he's basically been a member of DAA since we started it, and I can tell you that I've seen him grow so much, and I have no real explanation for it other than the hand of God, and something's gone on in his life, and I'm really excited to hear him tell us what happened. So please welcome Dylan to the stage.
My name's Dylan Isaacs. I'm a drug addict. My sobriety date is February the 7th of 2021, and for that I am eternally goddamn grateful. My home group's the Over the Bridge group of Drug Addicts Anonymous. I got one in CA as well, and I hold like two or three positions. Currently sponsor four guys. I got a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor, and he has a sponsor and on up the line. I'm very grateful that y'all would let me do this. So I got nine sisters, right? My mom's a cop, God rest her soul. And my dad is a car salesman. So from the time I knew how to talk, I knew how to lie. Real good, real fucking good. And somewhat of a normal childhood, or so I was led to believe, for roughly 20 something years. First stepmom, my dad and mom split when I was like three. My youngest memories, we lived in Vestavia. My dad moved across the parking lot from where my mom lived. So I walked from her apartment to his apartment with his new wife. A lot of chaos. I got two sisters that suffer from this disease. One of them's younger than me, but the older one was a very large influence in my life. And she was in and out of prison, back and forth from the truck stop, et cetera, you know. And at a young age, you know, I had this idea, right? Like, because people would tell me these things, no matter what happens, I'll never leave you. And it was a theme with women that I encountered very early on. So my sister, I didn't understand addiction. I didn't understand consequences, right? All I knew was you fucking left, right? Like, I must not be important enough. First stepmom, same thing, right? I remember I came home 8 years old, getting off the bus. She's packing up fucking dishes. You know, no, I'll still be here for you. Inevitably, she left. Second stepmom, alcoholic. And yeah, that was my first introduction to any type of mind-altering substance. Virginia Slims and Franzia box wine, do not recommend. Nothing magical happened. It was just gross. You know, it was not a great experience. And around this time, I was a fat, chubby kid and very awkward. Right, and I loved wrestling and setting shit on fire. And I always wanted to be somebody else, right? Like when I was like eight, I wanted to be Stone Cold Steve Austin. You know, I had the fucking intro music. I would chug Cokes on my porch. I don't know what I was doing, you know. But I didn't know it. And I didn't realize this shit at the time. I didn't realize it for a long part of my life. I never really enjoyed who I was, you know. And so like some weekends I would go to my mom's, right? And there was structure there. But fuck that, bro. I got to do what I wanted to do at my dad's. Second stepmom leaves. Third stepmom we got from a treatment center, and I really wish I was making that up. yeah. We were going to visit my sister at this female place that's no longer open, and I come home, and this chick's sitting on my couch, and I'm like, who the hell are you? She's like, I'm your new stepmom. I'm like, all right, cool, you know? And this is my first introduction to recovery, right? We would go to the hut, and I learned how to shoot pool there. I also developed this idea and belief system that every one of y'all were full of shit. Because she would leave, and then we would go to happy hour, right? So everybody in my life had some sort of anesthetic. It might not have been drugs. My mom's was bingo and NASCAR. My dad's was women in the gym and steroids. My sister's was crack and all this other shit. And that's the way, you know, I dealt with life. When I was 10, I got introduced to cocaine, Xanaxes, and ecstasy, and this is where shit gets fun. Until it wasn't. Something happened. The big book talks about in there's solution, this idea of a spiritual experience, because I don't know about y'all, but when I found the magic of cocaine and Xanaxes and ecstasy, I had a spiritual experience. Because I went from this shy, very awkward kid, right, to like life of the party. You know, I was like playing Donkey Kong 64, talking to my older sister's friends, like just the life of the room. And that shit worked until it didn't for a long time. If consequences would have kept me sober, you'd have a different speaker. I started getting school and jail consequences relatively early, about 11, 12 years old. But I didn't care, right? The fucked up part about this selfish thing that I suffer from, I don't care if it's good or bad attention. As long as you're paying attention to me and I'm the subject of conversation, I'm cool with it, right? Me. 13, you know, the progression starts, and life was still fun, y'all. If it wasn't fun, I'd have never done it, you know? I was 14, shit starts getting dark. So ecstasy was a big thing, and I was living in the suburbs at the time. Because if I had to classify the way I grew up, upper poverty, very lower middle class, depending on the way the car market went, right? My dad didn't pay taxes, IRS took a house. Subsequently, from there, everything was in one of my sister's names, right? He never had a license my entire life until I was like 19. From 1971 to 2009, he did not have a license. No cars registered, none of that. And I thought that was normal. You know, the way I was, these ideas and belief systems I was brought up under was you win no matter what, right? You roll over people no matter what. As long as I get what I need, then I'm okay. In the pretext of providing for your family and yourself. When I was 14, I was in Jonesboro, Atlanta, getting some ecstasy. And my best friend, they used to have these white butterfly menopause pills. I don't know if they still sell them. And we used to rip people off with them. My buddy ripped the wrong dude off. We were in a 300ZX, got shot 5 times in the head right beside me. I drove from Jonesboro, Atlanta to Heflin, Alabama. Residue of that murder on the side of me. In shock. Fucked up. 3 months later, right, and that sent me down this dark rabbit hole. It's when I started needing more and more, right? And about 3 months later, we're tripping and rolling. Another one of my buddies, he slits his throat, bled out my hands. About 4 or 5 months later, another one of my buddies blew his head off in my front yard with a shotgun. Not only did I have this idea that I have to be important for you not to leave me, right? Now everything I care about is going to die or leave me. The only thing that I really started to care about then was this relationship I had with Xanaxes and cocaine and, you know, whatever girl I could trick into being with me at the time. When I was 15, I did some dumb shit, went to Mount Meigs for a year and a day. If you're not familiar, it's a juvenile prison. And I did 1 year and 1 day in a one-man cell by myself. You either go crazy or get all right. And I would do a little bit of both. Let me back up. 2001, my dad broke his leg. And shit got rough. And I remember I had to steal some water out of the neighbor's garden hose to heat up to take a bath. And I made a vow to myself. My kid or me will never have to do this to survive. Inevitably, that did not come true, unfortunately, right? I grew up around a lot of crime, a lot of prostitution, a lot of shady dealings, if you will. My mom tried her best. She really did, God rest her soul. And she just wasn't around. My dad raised me, and it was trial by fire, baby. So I get out of Mount Meigs and I discover that this one of these girls I've been dating was pregnant. It's my first real shot at stopping on my own power. Because I never really wanted to. I don't know about y'all, but like the lifestyle was so fun. And then I bought into this lie that I'm not really a drug addict, right? I just like the lifestyle, whatever the hell that means. That's what my dad would tell me. And so I stopped, and I'm going to tell you for 30 days, that's an imaginary number. It felt like 3 years, probably 2 weeks if I had to guess. And my daughter was teething. And I remember I was working for my dad, and my dad was like, well, just put a little whiskey in her baby bottle. I was like, all right. you know, someone got a gallon of George Dickel, put a thimbleful in her bottle, drank the rest. Next 2 years are a blur, right? Decimated friendships, relationships, all that. Led a life of crime and a lot of pain, you know, and I never really liked opiates. Around this time, all my friends had started IV using. But I had this gift of God, knowing what I know now, that, like, consciously I knew that was going to take me too far too fast and I would die. So I could stay away from it until I couldn't. And so I get a DUI, July 13th, 2007. Never forget. Harry Potter, Chamber of the Secrets, or Order of the Phoenix had just come out. I was drunk as shit. And I got arrested, right? No big deal. I'm used to this. But it was a big deal because I got charged as an adult. And so they give me an ultimatum, right? So they tell me, you can either go to the Army or you can go to jail for however many days. And I was like, well, look, here's what I'll do, Your Honor. Because my intention was to bullshit my way through the entire process and then just come back and live life as I have been living it. How many of y'all, show of hands, don't like to be told what you won't do? Anybody else? All right, my people. So my family was very adamant, right? Because if you look at life like a marathon, I'm good for the first 10 feet and then I'm done. You know, this is too hard, I quit. Because I'd rather quit than fail. Or succeed, you know, I never know really. And so I was like, all right, I'm gonna show y'all. So I go to the Army at 17 years old, full of piss and vinegar. What stands out to me, right, is like I had this deadline. So I went in on like January the 1st. So I knew like December 27th, all drugs have to stop. When I tell you that was hard, that was real hard. So I just started using alcohol to cover up this internal condition that I was suffering from, right? Because I always wanted to be somewhere other than where I was, whether that be physically or mentally. I would drive around, right, not knowing I'm trying to escape myself. And it started taking more and more. So I get to the Army and I do good. Structure and discipline do me real good, right? If you tell Dylan how to live his life and what I should do, then I'm pretty good. You leave me to my own devices, we're in Mobile with a stolen 18-wheeler wondering how did we get here. That's a true story. And I did good, right? So first like 17 times I get on a plane, I jump out. First 13 times on a helicopter, get to fast rope out. It was cool. You know, they paid me to work out and shoot guns. I was full of piss and vinegar and America and George Bush and all that dumb shit. And I go to Afghanistan, get blown up 3 months in country, 17 years old. Really messed this shoulder up. Go to Germany, heal up, go to Iraq, get shot in the fucking foot, heal up, go back to Afghanistan, get blown to hell and back. And I'm lucky to be alive just from that experience alone. Well, when I landed, I got blown out of the machine gunner's turret. When I landed like a V. So the plate pushed the top of my lower back down and the ground pushed the bottom of it up. So my lower lumbars look like a sandwich, you know? And I never really liked opiates. They made me sick until they didn't, right? So that's how I started coping with this. And, you know, I had to fucking go through physical rehab and all that stuff. And I was like, listen, just write me a couple of scripts and I'll be fine. Come home, well, I go back to Benning, right? And my family had this delusion that somehow a geographical cure would fix me, like just never come back to Birmingham. Well, I did. And I went on a multi-state crime spree. And at 19 years old, I was facing 300 and something felonies, majority of which were Class A's. I got this chance, right? I made bond, and they send me this work release. I can't stop getting high. Can't stop getting high. Run, go to this girl's house, blah, blah, blah. She cheats on me. I get all butt hurt. Call dad and sister crying. You got to turn yourself in. Listen, let me detox off these OCs, and I'll turn myself in Monday. Monday comes, bullshit my way through it, go sit in some office building, you know, because I don't want to go to jail. We go to Brighton to pick my brother-in-law up. My dad made a fatal mistake. he left the keys in a car that had gas in it and left me unattended. I left that night and went on a run, hitting hospital emergency rooms. And next morning, down here by the projects they're tearing down, I called my friend. She said, you need to come over here. She told me my dad had died. I carried a lot of guilt and shame about that for many years, y'all. A lot. I ended up going to prison, 20 split five, 4 years and roughly 4 months of that I spent in a one-man cell. Got stabbed twice. That was fun. Zero stars on Google. Get out. Mom and them are still kind of riding with me. I go to treatment. Same song and dance. I'm looking for differences. I don't really want to stop. I want the consequences to stop. All those yets start happening. I hadn't compromised every value system and moral I've ever lived up to or thought I could live up to yet. You know, I hadn't seen my daughter since I was 16. She was roughly 6 months old. Her mom had moved on and got married. I experienced homelessness, you know, a lot of incomprehensible demoralization couldn't stop me. Around 2014, I get back into my daughter's life, and externally, things look good. I'm selling dope on the side, right? I have a place to stay, which was a big improvement. And I get back in my daughter's life, and I've always wanted to be a good father. You know, when I tell my story, sometimes my dad comes across as a bad dude, but he was a great man who loved me. He just did the best with what he had, right? And sometimes that's all we can do. I went to prison that night. Another 20 split five. Shit sucked. It got dark. A lot of meth psychosis, a lot of Xanaxes, right? Get out. Salvation Army. There's always a girl in my story until recently, right? She's like, you're not homeless. You can come live with me. So I go to Green Pond, Alabama. and, you know, she wasn't homeless. She had a trailer that had, you know, 1.5 million brown cockroaches in it, a car that didn't run. And I've lived in abandoned houses that were nicer, honestly. It's sad. And then, you know, the progression starts. I'm bouncing from whoever I can use to whoever I can use, right? Meth, heroin, liquid G. I'm just substituting one for the other because it wasn't stopping that was my problem. I couldn't stay stopped because I could detox. I'd sit in a hotel room, put the air on 60, and just sit there and throw up and be miserable. As soon as the physical gets away, right, I'm off. I reward myself with the very thing I'm trying to stay away from. I've done ayahuasca ceremonies with a shaman in Colombiana. you know, like... It was legit, okay? Don't judge me. Anything, because God wasn't my sister that's in active addiction right now, I had a lot of resentment against, but that woman saved my life, right? And I'll get to that in a second. Well, actually, I passed by it. So when I got out of prison the first time, I found out I was adopted, right? Everybody knew but me. My real mom left me at a dope house when I was roughly 18 months old, somewhere in there, right? My sister that's in active addiction is the one who got my family to adopt me. So even though it wasn't a great setup, it was a lot better than what I would have experienced, you know? You know, so I'm bouncing around. 2020 pandemic hits. I could keep a job for 30 to 90 days, right? But inevitably, I'm in the bathroom on my phone. You fill in the rest, doing meth. And, yeah. And so I get this job at McDonald's living with my niece, and then that stimulus hits. And 2 days later, it was gone, right? I start selling everything out of her shed. She's the last person to take a chance on me. I'm done with you. I go to this sober living. I was doing real great at the time. I think everything I owned fit in a shoebox. This is when I first met Paul and Brock. And I remember one of the first things I said to him, my first sponsor, is I don't know if I'm really powerless. Fuck me. I don't know that I understood powerlessness thing. I thought this was all about the Xanaxes, right? I didn't understand that there was no choice, no matter what, I get high, right? Because I would sit in meetings and I would hear people say things like, today I chose not to drink. I don't know how in the hell they did that. I really don't, right? I mean, the dope man in the parking lot. I met him in the parking lot on the way to detox. I can't stop myself. I don't have the mental power. I tried a very detrimental thing then. There's a part of me that's a hippie, and I saw a spiritual experience and figured I could eat mushrooms and work the steps, and that would be successful, until it wasn't, right? I tried everything but the right way. Because my whole life, all I know is cheat, steal, and lie. That's the way I show up. December 19th, right? But on the external, I fell into that trap that you hear in some meetings of fake it till you make it. That's dangerous advice for a guy like me. I've been faking it my whole fucking life. You tell me to just continue to do that. Okay, watch this. So externally, life gets better. Internally, I'm dying. I saved my last, saved up and finally got my daughter a Christmas present I've been promising for, I don't know, 14 years. And I go there and my kid's mother's twacked out of her mind on meth. Her new boyfriend's got my clothes on. And it's just not a great experience. To be honest with you, you know, welcome to the trailer park. And I hand my daughter this phone and this money. She spit on my shoe and told me, fuck you, just because you're out of prison doesn't mean you're my dad. Yikes. That was rough. Fast forward, you know, I end up continuing to relapse, right? I did shrooms for a while, then it was liquid G, then back to heroin and Xanaxes. I get real miserable. Somehow I wind up in Helena. I don't know. My first sponsor and his wife come and get me, take me to detox, and I'm in detox, right? And you would think. So I was almost willing to go to any length. But they wanted me to go sit in another psych ward, and I said, I'm not going to do it, right? Because I'm waiting to go up the street here. And so my logic was, I don't know about y'all, so I can't do heroin and Xanax. So I'll go live in a meth house and drink liquid G. That makes logical sense to a guy like me. And that was the most miserable week of my life. I experienced hopelessness at a level that I hope nobody else ever has to. It's the first time I ever intravenously used any sort of drug, and it got rough. And I remember February the 3rd, I was somehow talking my way into this dude's apartment downtown to take a shower. And I was calling my first sponsor, because see, I missed the boat. I missed the whole God piece here, because I fell into this trap of... you know, if I just sit close enough to one of you that seems to be doing the deal, I can just parrot what you say, right? And I'll get the results. Because he gave me the right instructions. I just wasn't taking the action, you know? My whole dependence was on him. I missed, you know, there's a part in how it works. No human power. I miss that. And he told me, dude, I don't know what to tell you. You're fucked. I can't help you. You don't listen to anything I got to tell you anyway. So, I mean, good luck. That's the best thing he ever did, besides fire me as a sponsee. I walked up here. I had this buddy that was a lot worse off than I was, which is scary. And but he seemed to be doing better, right? Because there's something about when you see, like, God transform somebody that you personally know's life. This is one thing for me to stand up here and tell you about me, but when you witness it, you're like, oh, there's something to that, right? Like, my ego had got thinned out just enough to go, maybe they're right, you know? So I walked up here. It was, like, half raining, half sleeting. It sucked. It was cold. And I sat about right there crying, picked up a silver chip. And then my sponsor now and this other man stood out by them picnic tables and told me the best, worst news I've ever heard in my life. You're fucked. No matter what you do, you're going to continue to get high. And see, I was out there on this rant about how I thought I could keep myself sober, right? I know what the problem is. I can't go here. No, bro. It doesn't matter. Your brain will take you back to a place. They broke down page 24 in a way I'd never heard it. I'm not saying nobody read it to me or said it to me, but I understood it at a gut level that I don't have a choice anymore. All I'm going to do is get high until I don't, right? It's a beautiful place to be, actually. Didn't feel like it at the time, let me tell you. And if it wasn't for some people in this room and people in this fellowship, because I had nobody. My family didn't want anything to do with me. I had nowhere to go, waiting on a bed in treatment. a couple of people took a chance on me and let me sleep on their couch, right? I had to be gone while they weren't there, but they still let me sleep there and shower there. They treated me with love and compassion, some shit I hadn't experienced in a long time. I followed a suggestion when I got into treatment that was like 8 months old and listened to a speaker tape. And I ran across this guy named Chris Raymer. He had this revolutionary idea that I had never heard. Work the steps fast. I was like, huh, right? Because this dude kind of told my story in a different, there was a lot of similarities, right? Sitting in the back of a meeting, dying on the inside, but acting like I'm perfectly okay. Not being able to identify with anybody. And I worked the steps and I had a magical experience. You know, and then I fell into this delusion, right? Because like when I came in, there's a line in our book that talks about spiritual living be an answer to all my problems. Well, when I was reading it, it said my drug problem, right? I missed the all. So I thought I knew what I was doing. So I moved out of this treatment center's apartments with this dude on the pretense of saving money because money was my God, right? And to be quite frank with you, when, you know, Paul met me and Brock first knew me, I was just a sober horse thief. I would still lie to you, try to manipulate you, you know. There was no, I missed the boat on a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, shit got miserable. And then in May, I'm doing this fishing tournament, right? This was a catalyst. And at that time, it was the darkest moment of my life. Doing this fishing tournament, I decided the steps were a cure-all for everything. I dropped myself from all my meds because I got a medical degree. It's in my car, right? you know, Dylan knows best. That's the theme. And so I'm miserable, bro. You know, I'm coming off all these psych meds and this other shit. And we're coming back from Gunnerville, me and a buddy, and I made the point-blank declaration. If I ever find out I got AIDS or cancer, I will kill myself. This is on a Saturday. I will never forget it. I come in, the dude I'm living with had all right to be mad because I've been lying to him, faking like I'm going to work, sitting on the Vulcan Trail rubbing leaves on me, right? Like, listen, bro, I would go to any length to fool you into thinking I was doing what I was doing. And that's a sadly true story. And it's the first time I've said that out loud in a while. But I knew I could manipulate them into a place to stay, right? Well, I didn't know about these newfangled cars because I'm stuck in 2007, right? That's like where my mind is. So I told him I was using his car to go see my mom and my sister, and I was on the, you know, the west side of town in Bessemer seeing this girl, and he caught me in a lie. And basically, he's like, you either pay me my money or you get the hell out of my house. So I gave him the money I had made from that fishing trip doing that thing, right? And I was like, look, I'll smooth this over, I'll make this right. And I come down here, we get into a text war, tells me he's gonna call the police, I'm never coming back, we'll holler at you. So now I'm homeless, sober, but homeless and miserable. And so I started a job that Monday and I was sleeping at a buddy's house right up the street here on the couch. And that job sucked, I hated it. I was raising money for politicians. Anyway, I get a call Wednesday, right? And I'm doing like phone sales and I get a call. It's from the Jefferson County Department of Public Health. I'm like, uh-oh, this ain't good, bro. This ain't good at all. So I try to get the lady to tell me on the phone and she's like, no, you gotta come in. So I set up an appointment for Friday and I walk. I just got paid. I had about $650-700. And nowhere to be besides work and no way to get there. I go in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the lady told me, after she set me in the lobby for 20 minutes, she said, Mr. Isaacs, you got HIV. White noise. You want to talk about getting punched in the mouth? I thought my life was over. I really did. I said the most sincere prayer I had ever said up to that point. Please help me because I don't know what the hell I'm fixing to do. Right? Because, like, my experience abundantly confirms that you could tell me, like, my mom's dog's veterinarian's daughter had a head cold. I'm going to get high. You know, it does not matter who it is. I'm looking for any excuse. I want to get loaded, right? Poor, pitiful Dylan. and like the hand of God throughout that whole, the way that played out, right? Like, it was like, somehow I ran into my manager who lived on the other side of town, got a ride to work, meeting, rinse, repeat. I went back through the steps because I felt like I had missed something, and I did, right? But I'm of the belief in my experiences confirmed that, like, the steps are not really the work. If one of them is, it's the 12th step, right? But all this, like, 1 through 11 just clears the ground for God to work through me. You know, like, I didn't get it until I gave it away. Like, intellectually, yeah, cool. You know, all right, I can kind of vibe with what y'all are saying. But, like, when I started teaching it is when it, like, really started resonating home. And the coolest part of this shit is, like, sitting across from a dude that's just as hopeless as I was. And you get to watch God work. How does Terry call it? The regenerative power of God. Like, lights click on. It's dope. It's better than any meth I've ever shot in my life. If you've never experienced it, you know, you might want to try. So I go, I'm at this sober living, and it's about August of last year. And I was talking to my roommate, who was subsequently my sponsee, and he had a good relationship with his son, right? And I hadn't really seen my kids. And I make this statement. And, like, I might never get to see my kids again, but I'm okay with it. I haven't been the most bang-up dad anyway. You know, I'm a dad in name only, right? I haven't, like, my actions have not dictated that I was a father. I've been completely selfish and not paid any attention to them. Wrote a bunch of sweet promises, come through, drop $20 off, keep the other $200, go get loaded, run off with some girl. That's how I showed up. And I said that, right? So that later, after I got over COVID, I made amends to their mom. That was very powerful, right? Because I didn't understand. Like, when I first came in, I thought this was like, the steps were bullet points. You know what I mean? Like, they were standalone. I didn't understand that they were a collective body of work and one feeds off the other, right? Like, the 12 step is not the end, it's the genesis, really, depending on which, you know, lens you want to look at it through. I started doing some things different too, right? So, like, you know, they talk about getting a home group. I actually got involved, right? Because, like, I thought a home group is just like, yeah, I go there every week. Nobody really knows me because I don't talk to anybody. You know what I mean? And, like, I really started working with prayer and meditation. I would say a lot about prayer, right? But meditation was non-existent. And something changed. Like, in me, I got this newfound, like, fire, which you could argue is a gift, right? I'm not quite sure. It didn't originate within me. I didn't wake up one day and go, I'm going to chase God like I chase dope. That was not a conscious thought I had. October, I made amends to my sister that her name's Brooke. I hope she finds her way back, but it was powerful, right? Because I had a lot of resentment. I had to pray for willingness on that one, right? But through, like, the experiences of making the amends before those, it opened my eyes to, like, how limited my perspective was. The first amends I ever made was for, like, lying to somebody. And they're like, oh, no, you only jeopardized my freedom and my wife's freedom, you know? Like, no big deal. I was like, damn, my view is really skewed, right? So, like, that set a fire up under my ass to, like, clean up the rest of my past. And I made quite a few. And the one I made to my sister was very powerful. It was eye-opening. Because as much as I used to love to sit up here and blame, like, all the traumatic things that happened to me because of her, she also saved my life quite a few times, you know? And I did a bunch of messed up things to her as well. That night, I was supposed to have a date. I'm in sober living. I'm not doing real hot. No car. You know, just got a job that was decent. A girl calls and cancels, you know, smart of her. And, what are we going to do? Sit in the park a lot? I mean, anyway, you know. I'm like, damn, bro, I guess I'm just going to watch football. My kid's mom calls. She's one of us. She's active duty right now. I pray she makes it here. But she's like, hey, do you want to go to this haunted house with me and the girls? And I'm like, yeah, of course I do. But she's like, all right, I'm on my way to come get you. The whole ride there, y'all, I've manufactured how every scenario is going to play out based on my last experience, right? Like, I've played it all out. I know how they're going to react and what I'm going to say. And we get there. Her boyfriend is there. He's also a dude I stabbed in prison. Needless to say, we don't get to see eye to eye. Right? It gets real, like, and he's also my sister's boyfriend's best friend. It gets real Alabama. I don't have a pie chart to explain, but I'm like, hey, man, listen, I'm not here for you or for him. You go deal with him. I'm here for my kids. Let's see if I can make this through this without crying. I walk in, and it's like I was never gone. Everything I had ever dreamed of and hoped for happened. They're like, hey, so glad you're here. Let's make TikToks. There's some dumbass video of me dancing on the internet, and there's been subsequent ones, right? We had a beautiful experience. It changed the trajectory of my recovery again, because I experienced, like, the promise I really wanted to come true, right? Brand new relationships, because I never had a relationship with these kids. I knew them in name. I didn't know what they liked to do. I'd have to call their mom. I knew nothing about them. And I would start calling 2-3 times every week. I didn't want to force myself down their throat. And I've always been Dylan, right? Never been called Dad. I continue to do the things in these fellowships that the men that came before me taught me to do, right? If you don't do H&I and you've been through the steps, I feel like you're missing the boat. It's one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had the pleasure of doing, right? Is going and carrying the message, not sitting in a meeting raising my hand, you know? Like, actually going out, taking some action behind it. November comes, November 5th, I get my first vacation day at work. I got a job as a result of this program that allowed me benefits and PTO and all kind of shit. I got 198 convictions, y'all. I don't know how I got it, but God. We get pulled over, me and my buddy, right? And I say, hey, man, it's good. We don't have to worry about anything, right? And they come back and say, Mr. Isaacs, I thought he said he was giving me a warning. He said, you got a warrant. I got to see if Jefferson County is going to come get you. I think I set a world record for thy will be done's that day. I really do. And through the grace of God, I got signed my own bond, which is gnarly. I was also still on probation, right? And it was a little scary. But what did I do? Like, there's this line in Bill's story that talks about, if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his life, his spiritual life, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot endure the certain trials and low spots ahead. Certain. That's a promise. It's going to happen. Not maybe. Will it? It will, right? So I train like I fight. What do I do when the wind starts blowing? So I get bonded out of jail. I had no car at the time. Still made a way to get to this treatment center to speak. Because I knew at a gut level, my life depends on my activity inside this fellowship. Not my job, not my relationship with my kids, none of that shit. I will smoke it all up. I've done it. November comes. I do this Thanksgiving Day thing here. Get to go see my kid. And she's getting ready to get her license. And my buddy's wife left me her car while they went out of town. That's crazy. You know, I used to rob everybody I know. You're leaving me a car and your house? That's cool. You know, it's baffling. And my daughter's like, she wanted to drive. And I was like, I can't let you. So she calls her friend whose house we're going to. She says, is it okay if my father comes with us? Whew. Fuck. Seems a lot, very inconsequential to some people, right? One of the deepest moments of my life. The acknowledgement that, like, you're claiming me, you know? It was deep. I cried the whole way home. Tears of joy. And I'm not a crying dude, but I am, if you know what I mean. And December comes. I finally show up, right? I graduate from sober living. That was cool. I get to show up for my daughter's birthday. Actually do what I said I was going to do and a little bit more, right? I wanted to get her a gun. She was against it. Anyway, that's just the way I am. January comes, nothing real impactful, right? I just continue to do the practices that people had laid out before me. My sobriety date is the last time Tom Brady won a Super Bowl, and hopefully not the last time. And the owner of the Bucks said, if you want to know how to get somewhere, ask somebody who's been there before, right? Because, like, it's not just about – I've noticed that very few people get here, stay here, die here in a sober state, right? So, like, I asked the people that have what I consider to be significant amounts of time, right, what do you do and why do you do it? I just did that, you know? I put my own little twist on, like, my meditation and the spiritual practices that I implement, but I stay true to the format. February 7th is my sobriety date. February the 15th, moved into my first ever apartment with my name on it. First legal document, I think, besides a warrant that's had my name on it, right? it was pretty awesome. My mom had a stroke April 9th when the hut had changed location. I get the call, and I hang up. I'm like, fuck, bro. You know, and I have this, like, this gut punch, because life happens. Like, it's not like I get sober and people stop dying. Seems like the opposite, actually. And I looked around, right, and, like, I was right where I needed to be at that moment. And I got transparent with, like, my sponsor, my old sponsor, my grand sponsor, and a couple other dudes, and I went in my buddy's car and cried and prayed my ass off. And then, you know, I just left it in God's hands. Luckily, she rebounded from that, right? The next week, I get to go. My PO let me go out of state to take my daughter, my buddy, and his daughter to Six Flags. Beautiful experience. The next week was my birthday. And I go see my mom, and, bro, I got a bunch of cool shit. I got these here cowboy boots, some cash, a pair of Vans, a couple of nice dinners. And I'm at my mom's. She said, Dylan, you look so good. Oh, fuck. Whatever you're doing, please keep on doing. I'm so proud of you. That's the third time in my life I've ever heard that woman utter those words to me. And one of those times I went to jail the same night. You know, like I authentically knew I'd made my mama proud, not I'd faked my way into it. And that's not the reason why I came here, bro. But goddamn if it wasn't a good byproduct, you know? I got my license for the first time in life, July 11th, which is also the day I got off probation. My daughter took me to my driving test, and a family tradition, it seems. you know, I get the opportunity to do a lot of things, right, that I've never... I remember, Brock, you told me you'd be amazed where your life is in 6 months from now if you honestly commit to this thing. And that statement stands up at 6 months. It stood up at a year. It stood up at 18 years. There's this line on page 66 or 67, and it's around fear, right? And it talks about God enabling us to match calamity with serenity. My most recent experience with that. September the 2nd or the 3rd, whatever that first Saturday of September was. It's the first month my boss has openly allowed us to be off on Saturdays, right? Because I get up 3:30 every morning, right? Been working 6 days a week. So I'm like, oh, man, you know. It's my niece, and she said, drink some coffee and get ready for some bad news, and I knew. Right, because my mom was 77 years old. And if ever there was the human embodiment of work and self-sacrifice for others, it was Suzanne Isaacs. She raised three generations of kids, majority of which were not hers, right? Sacrificed a lot of her personal time on because of mine and my sister's fuck-ups. Had to go piss in a sheriff's uniform. How embarrassing is that, right? And I get there, and what's crazy is, I was never the person. When my father passed, nobody wanted to tell me because everybody worried about how Dylan would react. Because of y'all and the people that showed me the way, my family doesn't have to worry anymore. And I don't know that I deserve that, right? But my sisters do. My mama damn sure did. And my kids do, right? The third tradition is very broad. My great-grand sponsor talks about this. He talks about the third tradition, right, is like as soon as I express a desire to want to stop using drugs, I'm on the team. Everybody that's on the team is not in the game. I can't sit up in a dope house and see you pull up a shot and expect to get high. How am I going to come in here, see you work steps, and expect to get recovered? Put me in the goddamn game. Right? There's I used to hear the 9-step promises and think those were accessible by sitting in a chair. That's not true. Not in my experience. Right? Like, there's some action that needs to be taken. You know, I'm going through one of the hardest periods I've ever had to go through as a human being. And it's not hopelessness, but it's like this idea of sitting what I've been running from for pretty much my entire adolescent and adult life, and that's feelings, right? But through the grace of God and the actions that I get to take, right, and the fellowship I have around me, I'm able to feel those things and continue to push. I thank y'all for y'all's time. My name's Dylan Isaacs. I'm a drug addict.